We live in a world where a quarterly foreign policy crisis happens every 2 days now. My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagerts, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about everything that happened in the last 2 weeks, basically, last 10 days, because that's basically the last time we recorded. Balder, I have a question for you because you are, as the listeners know, a little bit older than me. Has there ever been a time in your life where events developed at such a pace than right now? Because to me, this feels very stressful that I have to keep up with the news at this level and basically everything could be considered a black swan event.
Hi Dario. That's a fair question. And I suspect the answer is no. I mean, immediately my mind, when you ask that, my mind goes to the late 80s, early 90s, when there was, of course, the collapse of the old world order of the two superpowers, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and sort of the ushering in of supposedly a new liberal Western Walhalla, if you like. So you had a lot of events happening in the late 80s, early 90s that basically seemed also important and slightly chaotic and without anyone being clearly in control. However, the difference between that period and now is that at the time there was also this overarching sense that at least we were moving towards a better place, right? We didn't really know what the world was going to look like, but it seemed that the collapse of the Soviet Union, certainly for the West, was broadly a good thing, and that we were going to be able to shape the world into a better tomorrow. And now in 2024, the chaos that we're seeing in international relations seems to indicate the opposite, right? We're losing control and the world is moving to a place that might actually be quite a bit darker, certainly if you live in the West.
Very much, because, I mean, I think for my age, I've gone through my fair share of crises. There was a 2008 financial crisis, 2012 financial crisis. Then you had the refugee crisis in 2015 to 17. Then there was COVID. Then there was the war in Ukraine. Then now the war in the Middle East. I feel like I can talk about a fair share of crises here. And it really, with this one right now, with just this overall doom of negative trends and developments everywhere, it doesn't really feel like there's a light at the end of the tunnel, which was different with all the other cases, right? Even with COVID, everyone said, oh, this will be really dark for 2 years now, and afterwards we will be living in a different world, and this is going to have a big impact on everything else. But the pandemic will be over one day. And that feeling I don't really have right now, because it's just a big doom of negativity.
No, and it's interesting that you mentioned COVID, because I think no one seriously believed that COVID would continue to be such a huge medical problem, at least, or such a huge political problem in terms of deaths in the long term. But COVID was just another sign on the wall, another writing on the wall of a society that was losing the plot, right? That had lost the basic foundations of who it was supposed to be. So in many ways, I think we are now seeing an acceleration of processes that go way back, probably to 9/11, when the West essentially surrendered its identity on the global stage, but also internally. And slowly that started escalating like an avalanche rolling down the hill. And that acceleration is what we are now witnessing with greater violence and greater force. And that's scary if you live in the West.
Luckily, we've already analyzed and talked about all these developments from the past 20 years in our past episodes, which is why kind of we now have the time to not focus at them in these longer episodes, but we actually have the luxury of looking at all the developments in the last 2 weeks. Because otherwise, I don't think we would have the capacity to even talk about it, right? Just imagine we would have to record a 50-minute episode on, oh, why is this happening? What's the underlying dynamic here in the Western bubble? And then we would have to record an additional episode just talking about everything that happened in the last week.
Yeah, it's you and I have in the past often sort of brainstormed a little bit, like, would it make sense to have short episodes just to update our audience on events? But right now, I think we've got such a solid foundation. If anyone wants to know exactly how we believe the long-term evolution and the philosophical basis of this problem, what that looks like, they can go to all those other episodes, and that allows us to just focus on the politics of the day. But the politics, all these things that we're going to talk about are part of a broader picture, right? They're part of a broader spectrum of events that indicate a rapidly changing global society, certainly a rapidly changing Western society, that is, and it's unclear where that's going to lead to, and that's important to remember.
It very much is. And because of what I said in the beginning, that a quarterly foreign policy crisis is now taking place every 2 days, I'm concerned that before this episode is published, there will be another one. So for transparency, it is currently the 2nd of December. It's 9 p.m. Central European time, right? So in case anything happens, we didn't know about it. But what we did know about, and what we basically woke up with this morning, is the piece of news that Joe Biden, still U.S. president for a few more days or weeks, pardoned his own son, Hunter Biden, who has been involved in, let's just say, I think some shady stuff in the past, and who has been facing court cases for this already, and who most likely will be facing a lot more court cases, but not anymore, because Joe Biden just pardoned him for, I think, for everything, right? Just generally, hey, blank check, you're good.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing about Hunter Biden, broadly speaking, is that I think you're right to describe him as being involved in shady businesses. There's an air of dodginess around him, even when it goes to corruption charges with respect to using his father's leverage for his own business, international relations, being corrupted by having the son of a president and previously vice president and a previously important senator walking around the earth saying, "That's my dad, please work with me." The things that he was convicted for were specifically tax evasion and him lying when purchasing a gun, which seems like a relatively small thing. He was basically addicted to drugs when he bought that gun, and that goes against the law in the United States. Seems a relatively small thing, but it's a picture of a less than ideal human being, if you like. And it's like when Al Capone was convicted on tax charges. But of course, tax charges wasn't the worst that he did, right? That's kind of what happened here with Hunter Biden as well. And it's always been a little bit disturbing to me how Democrats found it difficult to just say, look, this is awful, and let justice run its course. And of course, we will support any verdict against him because this isn't right. And we are the party that believes in the American system. We believe in justice. We believe in the strengths of American institutions. And of course, we are happy to facilitate an investigation into him. That should have been their approach. And yet, they already always try to make it a little bit political. And now, unfortunately, with Father Biden making this decision, it's heartbreaking. It's very sad that this is now how the outgoing Democratic president is basically telling the world, telling his own country, you can no longer trust legal processes, you can no longer trust justice, and therefore I am going to pardon my son, which is basically undermining everything a U.S. president is supposed to be doing.
The only way this could be trumped is by Donald Trump, in case he pardons himself. But honestly, Joe Biden just laid the groundwork for this, right? Is that in 4 years, in case Trump leaves the White House, he will most likely just pardon all of his crew, right? Everyone in his team and around them. And then ultimately, right, he tried to do this, or at least he asked whether he could do this in 2021 already. He'll just pardon himself. And he can always point back at Biden and say, well, I wasn't the one, the first one to do it. That was a Democrat.
Absolutely. But I think that this what Joe Biden just did goes way beyond opening the door to Trump. We know that Trump, of course, this is great news for Trump. Trump loves this. It's going to make his life a lot easier. He's going to be able to corrupt the system. He's going to be able to twist the political narrative in his favor because of this. Of course, it's a huge gift that the outgoing president is giving to the new president. No doubt about it. But even if Donald Trump didn't exist, the fact that Biden said as a reason for pardoning his son, that this was because the prosecution of his son was political. That statement, that it was a political prosecution, regardless almost if whether it was true or not, right? The president saying prosecution of this individual was political is basically him saying to the American population, do not trust justice anymore. And so that is terrible, that is destructive by itself, regardless of whether Trump is going to abuse that further. Of course, Trump will abuse that further, but that's almost besides the point. If Joe Biden had said, look, I'm old, I've got a horrible history with, you know, with death in my family, my son died, my other son died, my first wife died, I cannot leave the White House without protecting my son. I know this isn't great, but I need to protect my son, therefore I'm going to pardon him. Then that would have been a different story. Then people would have said, well, look, we wish you hadn't. We wish you had been more principled. But the love of a father for a son is kind of, you know, trumps everything, right? It goes beyond anything. And that would have been much more acceptable. But the fact that he put it into a political code, the fact that he said, I do it because you can't trust justice because this prosecution was political, I mean, it's just such a dark, dark moment for American society. I hope that Democrats will understand this and respond in the proper critical way to this, and that they don't try to be tribal and somehow protect Biden's legacy in any way.
I'm not sure whether we can be that hopeful. At least I haven't heard any big voices as of now kind of condemning this move by Joe Biden. There, right, I was, before this episode, we were thinking, oh, how can we transition from this topic now with Joe Biden and Hunter Biden to one that we haven't really paid that much attention to in this podcast in the past few weeks. And then we remembered, of course, Hunter Biden was involved in some shady business because he also happened to be involved with Ukraine. And so now, speaking of Ukraine, Walder, one person who, I mean, I don't think he surprised us because we know that Zelensky is a very skilled diplomat, right? The president of Ukraine. But I was surprised how intensely he basically threw himself at Trump, saying that, oh, Donald, I'm so glad you're here. Wow, there's nothing better could have happened to us because you're going to end the world, the war very soon. And at the same time, right, behind Donald's back, he's still very much flirting with the current U.S. administration, securing all the funding and military assistance he can get.
Yeah, and this is politically the right approach for Zelensky, right? It requires you to kind of go down this hypocritical route. Maybe at night before going to bed, you have to have an extra shower to clean yourself from your from the dirt of politics. But if you want to get anything done with Trump, you have to deal with his ego. And Trump has said, I can solve the Ukraine war in what time frame did he give himself? A week or a day or a month or something like that. Right? He has made these statements. And of course, if Zelensky wants to be able to have a seat at the table, then he needs to facilitate that. He needs to give Trump the room to be the great savior of Ukraine or the great savior of the world by bringing peace. That's what Trump cares about. And so Zelensky is doing, in that sense, absolutely the right thing. Now, the reality is, of course, you're right in him trying to get as much support still as possible from Biden before Biden leaves office. But the reality is that the Trump election has been terrible news for Ukraine. And that when now Zelensky talks about a ceasefire and talks about we need to start negotiating some kind of peace, that is basically an admission that the past year and a half, 2 years have been really, really bad for Ukraine. That the euphoria of the early months or early 6 months or so is completely gone, has evaporated. And they now need to scramble to basically hold things together. And you do that by giving Trump a win and now putting pressure on Putin to also allow some kind of peace process to take place. And the end result of that will be that Ukraine will have to give up territory, will have to give political concessions. But the alternative would be worse. The alternative would be a war where there's no longer support from the White House, and Russia will slowly over time keep on pushing Ukraine back.
Yeah. You mentioned that Trump basically said, oh, I'll solve it within a week or month or until I'm president. That's a very interesting observation, because that's exactly his tactic with everything right now. And it's, I mean, I'm very close to calling it smart, because he's basically setting deadlines for everyone, right? He's saying that, oh, if this isn't resolved until I'm in the White House, I will unleash fire and fury, right? So he's building up all this diplomatic pressure, all this political pressure, letting the Biden administration do all the work behind the scenes, and then kind of cashing in the wins. And that's basically what happened with Israel and Lebanon and this, I don't know if it deserves a name, but the ceasefire that they agreed upon, where they basically said, okay, no more exchange of missiles. Israel gets to stay within a certain part of the territory, right? They get to keep a lot of control and so on and so forth. But again, it was kind of the influence of Trump that allowed the Biden administration to negotiate that quote-unquote ceasefire.
Yeah, and this is a thing that we've discussed over the years, certainly about the first Trump presidency. By the very nature of the man, he disturbs normal flows of diplomacy. He disturbs the normal way of doing things. And sometimes that can be very destructive, you know, not having a predictable occupant of the White House can be very scary for the world, because you need some stability from the strongest, most powerful nation on earth. On the other hand, it also allows sometimes to break through an impasse, right? And I think that it's very obvious that the war between Russia and Ukraine has been in an impasse. Slowly Russia gaining ground, but extremely slowly. It has been compared to trench warfare, as if this is the World War One, as if we're 100 years back in time, with very slow progress on the Russian side. And the fact that Trump is Trump allows things to change radically. Now, the same was starting to happen with Israel and Lebanon, in the sense that Israel is running out of steam. They don't know why they're doing what they're doing anymore. It's completely unclear what they are achieving, what does success look like from Israel. But they can't admit that very easily, because that would be, of course, a huge, that would lead to all kinds of difficult conversations internally. Politically, that's not feasible to say, hey, we messed up. And but with Trump coming to office, it breaks through that dynamic. It breaks through the rhythm. And that allows people to try different things. Now, the ceasefire is, of course, not a serious ceasefire, but at least it allows for people to think differently about the future. Now, imagine Harris having been elected president. This would not have been happening, right? History would have continued going in the same direction. At least Trump disturbs these dynamics in a way that sometimes brings some light to the table, if you like. I mean, to quote the amazing Leonard Cohen here, there's a crack in every wall, and that's how the light comes in. Trump basically rips open those walls, right? And sometimes that's bad, and sometimes that's positive.
I find it very interesting what you said about Israel, that they're running out of steam, but at the same time, they don't really know what they're achieving. I mean, I think that, right, internally within the Israeli government, I think they are still defining this as a success story, right? Basically having taken out Hezbollah almost completely, and kind of having gained a lot of control over Lebanon there, right? Reserving the rights to intervene at any point whenever they deem it necessary, which, since the ceasefire has been in place, they deemed that necessary a lot of times already. It almost seems like within that Israeli government, they are kind of high on their own military success right now, right? And when I talk about military success, I mean they're winning battles, they're winning the exchange of rockets, and they're advancing in some ways. But again, what's the political end goal, right? Because you can have all your little military victories that you want, but if there's no vision, then you're just continuing this and you're remaining high on your own supply.
Yeah, it's a bit reminiscent of the first 3 or 4 months of the US invasion of Iraq in 2003, where, you know, after 4 months or whatever it was, George W. Bush went on this aircraft carrier with a big banner behind him saying mission accomplished, because they had this amazing military victory, which no one ever doubted. No one ever doubted that the US would obviously literally destroy the Iraqi Republican Guard, with a lot of young men dying as a result, but it was obviously a military victory. But then came the real struggle, because what do you do next? Nobody has ever doubted, I think, that Israel, if they want to, they can have these military victories, depending on how you define victory. But you cannot eradicate Hezbollah, you know. So their narrative might be, hey, we've wiped out large segments of Hezbollah, we've killed leader after leader after leader, well, congratulations. But at some point, the violence has to stop and Hezbollah will be back, you know. And if it's not called Hezbollah, it will be something similar to Hezbollah. So I even find it almost difficult to call military victories victories. You manage to kill enemies or people you believe are enemies. And then what? You know, what's the point? How does your average Israeli citizen benefit from that? That's completely unclear. But that is a conversation that obviously the government can't have with itself. What is fascinating is that within Israeli society, you now have sort of the left, which has been disturbingly quiet, I would argue, sort of the you know, the people who go protesting in the streets, but these are not large protests. These are relatively small protests. The political left coming together with Orthodox Jewish people, because the Orthodox community is also outraged by this, because they understand that their way of life, their long-term existence is under threat by this violence. They don't care about what Netanyahu is doing at all. They just want to live in a stable, secure Israel. And everything that's happened over the past year has made Israel less stable and less secure. So you have these two extremes coming together in their criticism for the Israeli government.
Yeah, but isn't the criticism of the Israeli government from the Orthodox coming from a different point, where they just don't want their own people drafted into the Israeli Defense Forces, and that's the reason why they opposed to these military actions? I don't think they would mind these military actions if everyone but themselves had to conduct them.
Actually, I mean, that's of course a very practical thing, and that goes hand in hand, but that can't be disconnected from the fact that the true Orthodox community doesn't care about the geopolitics. So if you create layers of Israeli society, greater Israel, sort of modern day, if you like, radical Zionism, like let's get rid of all the Palestinians and let's make sure that the borders of Israel get pushed in every direction, has not necessarily been supported by Orthodox Jewish people. The settlers typically you have to look at every case separately, of course, but typically settlers are not that hardcore religious community. They are people who are within the Netanyahu crowd, who do believe in a greater Israel and who don't care about the spiritual aspect of it, if you like. True, I have to be careful with the word true, but the Orthodox community that has consistently been skeptical and critical of Netanyahu do not just position themselves because they don't want to be drafted. They position themselves because they believe that the only thing that matters is to live in a stable, secure Israel. And what the actual borders of that Israel are is much less relevant to them.
Mm. A few minutes ago, you mentioned that Trump's approach to foreign policy can be basically a crack of light in some instances, right? So, for example, in the Russia-Ukraine war, also, I mean, achieving at least something that you can kind of call a ceasefire, I think can be considered a success, because fewer missiles are being dropped. So I think for the people on the ground, that is positive. And then you also mentioned that some of these like unstable decisions by Trump are really, really hurtful because you do need a hegemon that you can somewhat rely on. One of the cases where Trump made one of those decisions that was very erratic, very, very quick, right? We've analyzed this in a past episode, was in Syria, related to Turkey. And that's the next topic, because while all of this is happening, right, there's also one of our, I'm almost ready to call them patients, right, who are kind of like on the intensive care unit, and they've some been in somewhat of a terrible coma for the last for the last few years. At least the news is now paying attention to them, because you've had a somewhat stable situation within Syria. And when I say somewhat stable in Syria, we're still talking to 30 to 100 people dying every week from the violence, right? That is considered stability in Syria. But now there are more developments, or new developments, where basically rebel forces, a wild combination between jihadi groups, right, kind of some of them associated with certain parts of ISIS, some associated with other parts. It's a very complicated situation. They have now grouped together, and they are moving against the Assad government, and they have just taken Aleppo, the second largest city in Syria, and there's some serious talk that Assad seems to be in some serious trouble.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that the... So one of the reasons why certainly Western media stopped covering it was that it was seen as a geopolitical defeat by the West. Essentially, it was a victory for Russia that the Assad government stayed in power. But the underlying problems that had actually caused the civil war, and civil war is, you know, even putting it mildly, because it was just chaos, but the that caused the violence to occur in Syria were never resolved, right? So essentially, the geopolitical fight was won by Russia for this short to medium term, but Syrian society hadn't found a new point of stability, hadn't found any kind of sustainable future ahead of itself. And certainly Turkey didn't help from the north. Remaining elements from ISIS didn't help. The very complicated relationship between the Assad government and the Kurds didn't help. But the overarching problem is that Syria is basically right now the battleground between different geopolitical forces. And this is now the result of that. Russia has been actively bombing positions against the Assad regime, so to support the Assad regime, of course, against the enemies of the Assad regime. And it is very unclear what's going to happen next. I would be surprised, but you know, you should never make predictions. I would be surprised if this will lead to the same chaos and violence that we saw 10 years ago. I don't think that's going to happen. Basically because the West is no longer as active as they used to. So, it's very much between Turkey, Syria, Iran, and Russia. And I think those three actors will have to somehow come to some kind of agreement about what they want there. It is a fascinating story, and it's a story of human tragedy and human suffering that is unlikely to be resolved anytime soon.
It's very interesting to observe the Western role here, because the United States, the White House, took its sweet time to even comment on the situation. And today I read that under Italian leadership, the Europeans are concerned and they're monitoring the situation.
This
whole podcast has been about the West should stay out of international relations and out of conflict zones, so it can be perceived as a good thing. But at the same time, I think it more highlights the lack of any strategic vision that Europe, but also the United States, right, has for this country. For Syria, there's no plan what's going on. They don't know what it will mean for themselves, and they don't know how to respond to it in any type of way.
But this is typical for the Western position in the Middle East in general, and even Afghanistan, for example. The West has been kicked out of Middle Eastern politics to a large extent. Now, its power that it still has, its influence, it derives indirectly through allies. Israel, maybe Saudi Arabia, depending on the decade, Egypt. But the West no longer has any serious influence. That war has been won by, if you like, Russia, Iran, Turkey, and China. And that means that the West has a really big problem because they made Assad enemy number one. I mean, I don't know if you are old enough to remember this, but Assad for a while was on the hit list for all every European government and every North American government. He is the guy that we need to get rid of. And the West didn't get rid of him. The West had to retreat in a horribly embarrassing way, basically say, we can't win this. We are no longer as powerful as we used to be. And therefore, whenever Syria comes up, it's kind of an unpleasant memory from a past long gone for the West, right? So then they say, we're monitoring. Yeah, there's not much you can do. You can bet your life on the fact that European intelligence agencies and the CIA, MI6, are active there. And they're still sending money and support to certain groups. Their relationship with the Kurds has deteriorated since the Trump presidency, because Trump basically gave up on them. But there is still Western money and Western support flowing to specific groups, but they can no longer compete with the influence that Iran and Turkey and Russia especially exert over the country. And it means that they kind of see Syria as a symbol, the canary on the coal mine, if you like, of their declining geopolitical power. And it's painful for them. And they have to witness it slowly evolving in a way that is completely out of their control.
Well, is this a lack of ability or a lack of willpower? Because I'm thinking the entire time, is the West taking lessons from Libya, right? Where they did get rid of the bad guy of Gaddafi, right? This is another episode that we've recorded in the past. So they did get rid of him, and then it just threw Libya into total chaos and actually caused some serious problems for the West later down the line. And now in Syria, they're saying, well, we don't like Assad, he's the bad guy. We tried to kick him out, but we couldn't. But at least he is keeping the country stable enough so that not more refugees are coming to Europe.
Yeah, so it's both. It's and I think those two things go hand in hand. It is them recognizing that they no longer have the influence and the power to shape the world into their own image, if they ever had it in the first place, but at least they now are aware that they don't. And secondly, and that's partially as a result of this, they don't want to. They don't want to burn their hands anymore. Syria was hugely embarrassing for them. Syria was really, really painful, just like Afghanistan was very, very painful. Libya, a little bit less painful because the world has paid less attention to Libya. But if you look at the facts, it's just been as disastrous. Wherever the West has gone in the 21st century, they left a trail of violence and destruction without actually anything to show for it, without being able to say, okay, people died, cities were bombed, but here is a good outcome. The West has not been able to claim any positives out of its foreign policy over the past 20 years. And Syria is the worst, kind of most painful case. And as a result, they don't want to think about it. And even if they were to think about it, there's not much they can do except for trying to manipulate certain groups here or there.
Yeah, but there was Iraq. Iraq was not successful, no?
Again, you're too young, Dario, to remember Iraq in 2008, 2010, 2012. If you had asked any Iraqi then, would you prefer Saddam Hussein or the situation we live in now? The answer was pretty, pretty obvious. Now, so Iraq was disastrous. And yeah, you can talk about a stabilized Iraq now, but from a geopolitical perspective, it hasn't helped the West in any way, shape or form. Libya, disastrous. Afghanistan, 20 years of horrific civil war, with Western soldiers dying, but especially the local population suffering tremendously. only to revert back to exactly the same political situation that it had been in before the invasion of 2002. Syria, complete disaster. Politics towards Israel and the Middle East in general, absolute disaster. Western Africa, complete disaster. The West has been burnt over and over again for these past 20 years. And the only reasonable conclusion to draw from that is to say, we have to stop doing that. We have to stop trying to interfere with societies that are not our own. And we have enough trouble at home in our domestic political situations within Western Europe, within North America. Let's focus on that and stop believing that we are the knight in shiny armor bringing Western values and prosperity to the rest of the world.
Well, then I want to look at a Western country now that has some internal troubles. At least every Georgian, and I'm talking about the country, not the state, every Georgian that I've ever talked to has considered themselves to be European and Western. So I believe now that they are part of the Western world, and therefore I could have an opinion on their internal business. Because Georgia has been in quite a bit of chaos in the past few days, right? Because everything happened in the past few days. There's nothing that happened a month ago. No, everything happened in the past few days, where the main party in power in Georgia, Georgian Dream, kind of said, oh, you know what? This whole European Union thing is a great idea and everything, but it's not for us. And we no longer want this, right? This is a horribly short version of what has happened in Georgia. But for the sake of this podcast, I think it's enough. Balder, as a Westerner, you now get to have an opinion on this Western problem.
Well, unfortunately, I can continue my rant about Western foreign policy here, because it's a similar case as what you saw with Ukraine. Even Armenia can be included in this, potentially even the Balkans. So I'm not really interested in labeling who's Western or not. Who am I to say is Western? It's not easy to put people into boxes like that. It's an oversimplification that doesn't make any sense. It's obvious that Georgian history, culture, society has a lot of connections with the West, and if they want to call themselves Western, that's absolutely fine. Who am I to disagree? But what I care about is how geopolitical forces influence countries. And it is very clear that if you like the core of Western geopolitics, Washington, Paris, London, Berlin, maybe, I see you shake your head. I mean, Germany has a lot of influence, but they're always a little bit more modest about it, right? How these core pillars of Western geopolitics, they have been now, after seeing the inability to shape the world in any military way, after the chaos that was created by the West in the countries we just mentioned, Iraq, Afghanistan, etc., they've tried to do it through diplomacy. They've tried to make the European Union and NATO some kind of diplomatic force pushing Western values towards, if you like, Russian borders, because it's mostly about Russia. And in the case of NATO, that's of course insane. NATO is a military organization. It's a very aggressively military organization. In the case of the European Union, I think it's more problematic because the EU is not some kind of foreign policy instrument. The EU is a project very much focused on a internal European dynamic. And one should be very careful with corrupting that process, but making it into something else. On a side note, the United States has always been trying to make the European Union a foreign policy instrument. The US is very comfortable with that because they don't want a coherent, consistently strong internal Europe. They want a weak Europe that sort of allows Western forces to play games with its periphery. The European Union and NATO, through a recognition that military means no longer work, have been trying to become this diplomatic force against Russia. And it's absolutely against Russia. It's not for Georgia. It is not for Armenia. It's not for Ukraine. It is against Russia. And that's an important thing to realize if you're Ukrainian or if you're Georgian. I've seen this with my own eyes in Brussels and elsewhere. It is completely obvious. Your average European, Western European, doesn't particularly care about the plight of Georgians, doesn't particularly care about the plight of Europeans. What they care about is limiting Russia. And through this diplomatic push, they basically force these countries to actively choose, to say either you're with us or you're against us. They forced politicians in Armenia, in Georgia, and Ukraine to very actively declare their loyalty towards the West or not, or declare their loyalty towards Russia. And as a result, the West has once again become this insanely destructive force, pretending that they're the good guys against authoritarian Russia, but they are actually pushing societies into a place where they it becomes 50% who wants to be European, who wants to become part of the European Union or NATO, 50% who feels more closely connected to Russia and Moscow. And that leads to this disastrous friction, this disastrous internal turmoil that we are witnessing in these countries right now.
I think I differ on this. I mean, not on the part where you said that the EU, right, and policymakers within the EU, they don't really care about these countries and the people there. They only care about going against Russia very much. In the case of Georgia, I think, and I had the privilege of listening to basically an analyst, right, from Georgian television who came to Raya to give a seminar about this. I think just 2 weeks ago, right? So before all this turmoil started. And he kind of laid out how the clear majority of Georgia is very much pro-EU and pro-NATO. Not so much, I think, because they believe into that project, but more because of the fear of Russia, right? Because they have seen it with their very own eyes in this generation, what it means to live close to Russia, right? With Russia kind of grabbing two of the regions of Georgia. And there, the country is more divided, of course, again, like between the city and the rural areas. And some of these rural areas are also just ethnically different, right? Where people don't even speak Georgian and they're also just of different ethnicities. But I think in Georgia, I see it a little bit more favorably, like for the West, right? Where I'm like, okay, there are people who see themselves as European. They see the kind of the EU as a safety mechanism against Russia, and therefore they would like to join. And they're doing this based on false promises, basically from the EU, where the EU says, oh yeah, of course, come, yeah, brothers and sisters in mind and in spirit, come here. Let's weaken Russia further, right? So I do think I would like to differentiate between kind of what the EU and what the West sees here and maybe what the Georgians say.
Listeners always like it when we disagree, because that's one of the most common criticisms, that we have too much of the similar narrative. In this case, I don't know if it's really a difference of perspective, though, because maybe when I mentioned 50-50, I meant more with respect to Ukraine. Before the war, right? Now it's not 50-50 at all. It's, you know, if you're pro-Russian, then you're in the very clear minority in Ukraine. But I'm not really interested in the percentages as such. You can put any percentage on it, 70-30. I would say that there's a bias typically in media, in Armenia, in Georgia, in Ukraine, towards sort of the intellectual liberals who automatically are more connected to the West, right? So in that sense, you have to be a little bit careful with being clear about these percentages. But what the Western expansion does diplomatically is it forces people to choose. So essentially, let's say that for the sake of argument, that 80% of Georgian society is inherently, organically, naturally more pro-Western, more fearful of Russia, and therefore being a clear majority. I don't think it's that obvious, but let's take that position. Then over time, slowly, that will turn the country more and more into the Western sphere of influence. It will create more business connections with the West, more political, diplomatic connections with the West, and it will slowly, over time, sideline Russian influence. But if you now come in from the West and say, okay, we don't have this time, you now have to choose, all of a sudden you create a conflict within that society, right? And that is something that the West is very good at doing, at creating an unnecessary conflict that all of a sudden forces these clashes. And that's exactly what you're seeing in Georgia. So even if the current government only represents 20% and the president represents the 80%, even then, this current situation of either you're with us or you're against us has been accelerated, has been amplified, has been in many ways caused by Western influence and Western foreign policy, by basically saying, hey, you now need to choose. Do you want to be part of the EU or not? Remember that Ukraine started, the war in Ukraine was after this whole dynamic of, are you going to join NATO or not? At that moment, alarm bells start ringing in Moscow. At that moment, alarm bells start ringing in pro-Russian groups within Georgia, within Ukraine, and it becomes a thing, right? It is like a bull in a china shop. It's the West saying, oh yeah, no, let's talk, and we've got your back. And then when Russia actually takes action, when they annex parts of Georgia, or they annex Crimea, and or they invade invade Ukraine fully, then all of a sudden West says, oh yeah, well, you know, we're trying to help, but there's not that much we can do. Our bad. Hopefully you can sort it out and we can continue talking later. I think that's the problem with Western foreign policy.
Yes, I think, yeah. I mean, I can certainly agree with that. Because
oh, that's a shame, because listeners want you to disagree, Dario.
Well, I find it difficult, right, to kind of speak for the Georgians or about the Georgians, right? Because I mean, there are numbers and percentages that are kind of coming out of this. I might just be very heavily influenced by that seminar I had from this Georgian analyst a few weeks ago, right, who kind of said that 80% of Georgians are pro-EU, like pro-joining the European Union.
Sure, but my point is that it doesn't really matter.
Exactly.
Because I'm not claiming that I know the Georgian spirit or Georgian political perspectives. I'm saying that Georgia has been forced into an impossible position, whether it's 80% or 50% or 99%, in an impossible position with having these talks with the EU, talks with NATO, well, Georgia less so than Ukraine, but these kinds of conversations have forced Georgian society to become a playing ball between Moscow and the West, and that is bad news if you're Georgian, regardless of what your perspectives are on this.
Absolutely. I mean, and I remember I personally experienced how much the EU kind of invests into having a good reputation in Georgia, because I remember I once interviewed for a position at a basically public relations company, right? And one of their main clients was the European Union, and their main project was kind of creating favorable narratives around the European Union in Georgia, right? So just from that very personal experience, I do see that Western foreign policy quite intensely.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that the West will never fully understand. They will never fully understand the impact that they have on these situations. And that the moment you do this, that there's a responsibility on your shoulders that you then have to be responsible for. And the moment disaster strikes, the moment chaos erupts, as we see now in Georgia and as we see in the war in Ukraine, then the Europeans are like, oh, well, it's not really our fault, but we'll try to help out in any way we can, which is not particularly useful, but it seems to be the way that the West operates these days.
Well, that seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on Joe Biden pardoning Hunter Biden, on Zelensky trying to get on the good side with Donald Trump, on Donald Trump's influence on the ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon, on the situation in Syria and on Georgia and chaos. And there were still like 3-4 more topics that we wanted to talk about, but we just couldn't because we didn't have the time. So if you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com. gmail.com. And we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes, because next week there will certainly be enough topics to talk about, just to continue this ever ongoing conversation. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
Well, I thought it was useful to get a quote talking about the world we're heading into, the anarchical world, the fact that we might be at a moment where historically 100 or 200 years from now, people say that was the moment that chaos began. And I found this word, this quote by Werner Herzog, who I'm outraged to discover you didn't know as a German, amazing filmmaker and cultural icon. And Herzog said, "Civilization is like a thin layer of ice upon a deep ocean of chaos and darkness."